to Quest for Gold, episode 15. I'm Ryan Burrow. We are 266 days out from the Olympic opening ceremonies in Paris, and I'm at Centennial Park in Atlanta, home of the 1996 Olympic Games. This park is open space now, full of monuments, Olympic rings, pools of water, and of course those iconic ringed fountains, which you can hear next to me. There's also a marker about 100 yards away commemorating Richard Jewell, the man described as a hero for saving lives when a pipe bomb exploded during an evening concert here at the Games. You may remember Jewell was falsely accused of planting that bomb. His name was eventually cleared, but only after his reputation and career were ruined. He died in 2007. We did a deep dive on the Richard Jewell case in a Quest for Gold episode way back in December of 2019. Feel free to go back and have a listen. We've also got some photos from Centennial Olympic Park on our website, WGNradio.com. It's appropriate that we're here at this location because we want to talk about Olympic cities this week. How do bids come to be? How do cities turn into contenders and eventually host cities for the Games? Sometimes it's governments who push for the Games. Sometimes it's corporations. Here in Atlanta, it started with an effort by a real estate lawyer. This week on Quest for Gold, I had a chance to speak with Terrence Burns. He's worked on 13 Olympic bids, including 5 winning bids, among other major sporting events from the World Cup to golf tournaments. I wanted to know what it takes in the current climate to secure an Olympic bid, what's changed over the years, and how cities, nations, and the International Olympic Committee approach the process of an Olympic bid for a Games that could be a decade away.
I'm the owner and chairman of T-Burn Sports Group, LLC.
And in that role, you specifically do work with Olympic bids.
Yeah, I mainly work in the Olympic world. Bidding is part of it, but also work for Olympic sponsors as well, or companies that want to be sponsors. That's how I got my start, actually, as a sponsor with Delta Airlines before I went to the International Olympic Committee with Meridian Management. So, Allianz was my most recent top partner client. And we went on early on with them to help them frame up their branding and actually negotiate their deal with the IOC and work on internal structure, et cetera. So we're at a very high level on the front end, working with sponsors on strategy and getting their deal done. We're not a agency of record, and we don't do activation type stuff. And when I say we, it's me. And if I need subject matter experts, I go out and hire them individually. I don't want to ever run and own a big agency. Again, I've done that a few times and sold them, and now I'm at a different level in my career. So I'm enjoying being a one man band, I guess is a better way to say it.
The best boss is yourself, right?
For sure. Yeah. Certainly the most forgiving.
How many Olympic bids have you been a part of, and over how long a time?
Since 2020. Excuse me, beg your pardon, since 2000, the year 2000, me and my ex-partner, George Hurtler, worked on the Beijing 2008 bid, and that was the first one, and we were fortunate enough to be successful, then Vancouver, et cetera. So I've worked on, I think, 13 Olympic bid campaigns, 5 of which were successful. I've worked on 2 FIFA World Cup campaigns. Both of those were successful. Golf into the Olympic Games, wrestling into the Olympic Games, just helped modern pentathlon survive to stay in for 2028 with LA. You know, a couple of the Asian Games, 2030 Asian Games. I helped Doha win that one a couple of years ago. So it's just kind of a plethora of different and disparate clients, and some assignments are private and confidential, may revolve around one individual, and some are Olympic bids, et cetera. But the entire bid process, and well, certainly what I did for 13 Olympic bids, and most recently LA, serving as their CMO, chief marketing officer, for 2 years, that process is gone. And I think that's what we want to talk about today, and how that's changed, and why, and what are the implications for it.
You sent me the link with a very descriptive, detailed kind of rundown.
Did you make it?
How 2024.
Did you make it through it?
I did. I got through LA, which initially was a 2024 bid. They ended up getting the
28 games. And I think in one part, you said something that really hit home with me about how the process is kind of like a glacier. You see what's going on the surface. That's what we all see. But what's going on underneath the surface is kind of where all the action is, at least kind of how you're dealing with it. You brought up, I'm fascinated with the kind of the idea of the birth of a city into this movement. And is it a matter of a bunch of really wealthy people coming together and say, hey, we should do this? You know, it'd be really cool if this city hosted. Is it government that comes, maybe a combination of the two, that says, hey, we really like to do this? How does it get birthed?
Depends on the type of country, the type of government, the political and social construct. I would say that obviously a bid from China is very different than a bid from the United States. You know, the LA 28 bid was a privately funded bid. Casey Wasserman started it. It's public knowledge. We spent around $50 million U.S., and those were $1 million checks at a time from individuals that Casey knew. And the Olympic Games in the United States will be a purely privately funded affair, except for the United States will pitch in on the security budget. That is 180 degrees from some other countries where it's a national effort with national funding, municipal funding. It just depends. You know, the Atlanta Games is a quixotic story of one guy who got inspired, Billy Payne, supposedly in church, and went around and knew nothing about the Olympics. He just loved them and wanted them in Atlanta, and was an absolutely inexhaustible supply of spirit and campaigning, and went out and convinced the Olympic movement to bring the games to some place, frankly, most of them have never heard of before. And he did that with the city fathers and some of the government, but he also hooked up with a gentleman named Andy Young, who was the co-chair of the games, and Andy was also the ambassador to the UN, et cetera. So it is a inconsistent mix of all of the above, but the further away you are from a liberal Western democracy, the more structured and nationalistic that effort typically is and funded.
And then one of the things that you brought up is you got to create that theme, that tagline, that thing that's going to sell it. And my guess is not only to the international community, but also to the people back at home.
To a degree, yes. At the end of the day, if you have five or six cities competing, there are probably three that are neck and neck in terms of a functional ability to do it. In other words, they all have similar plans, similar venues, similar hotel capacity, similar roads, you know, just all the stuff that you need, all the technical foundation you need to host a summer games. And then it becomes, and what I kind of figured out early on with help from my partners at the time, is this technical process really could use some storytelling. And I think one of the ways that we figured out that we could differentiate our clients' bids was to create a vision that could articulate, and this is crucial, why we were different from the other cities, not from a functional level, but from an emotional level. And then the tricky part is, is that difference important to the voters, to the Olympic parties? And that's where it takes a lot of time, takes a lot of thought. It's very easy to tell you why Pittsburgh is different from Naples, Italy. That's kind of easy to do. But once you put those two buckets of differences together, you have to start thinking about which one of these differences really matter to the Olympic movement to host an Olympic Games. Because frankly, it's obvious what hosting an Olympic Games will do for a potential host city, for a candidate city. Kind of obvious what it's going to do. You have to articulate that. You have to get buy-in from the public, especially in liberal Western democracies now. That's more and more important. And really, the bottom line there is, it's pretty simple. It's not going to cost you any money to host the Olympic Games. If you can't get past that sentence, you're going to have a hard time in today's environment. So being able to articulate back to the movement, yes, it's going to help our city. It's going to help our, it's part of our long-term plan. We're not spending any money. This stuff's already here. The games fit perfectly with the vision of our city in the future. Okay, that's table stakes. You got to say it. Everybody says it. But you also have to buttress that with, this is what we can bring to the Olympic movement that's different from the other cities. And this is why we think it's important for you. This is the value proposition for you. You know what the value proposition is for us. Here's the value proposition to the Olympic movement and to sport. And I think more often than not, we've been able to articulate that well and be successful.
Every city, it's got to be different and unique to that time, right? Like the folks here in Chicago where I'm at can't just, you know, blow off the dust from the 2016 bid and say, okay, we want to submit this now for 2036, right? Different times, different IOC, different changes. You can't just, there's no cookie cutter way to present this.
Not really. As you haven't read the Pyeongchang case study. So Pyeongchang did try to do that. They bid for the 2010 Winter Games, lost to Vancouver. I worked for Vancouver. They bid for the 2014 Games, lost to Sochi. I worked for Sochi. Then they decided they were going to bid on 2018, and I finally got a call from them. And they were wed, innocently, maybe naively, they were still wed to the story of, we want the Olympic Games to reunite the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, I'm a consultant. I get paid to tell people the truth, baby, maybe not what they want to hear. But I just said, look, that narrative is already lost two times. So we can debate whether that's a good narrative or a bad narrative. I like math. If you've lost the last two times using that narrative, maybe that's not the right narrative. And it being Korea, they were very aggressively protective of that narrative and wanted to argue. And I finally won that argument, and we changed to something called New Horizons, which was about bringing winter sport to Asia. This is way before Beijing 2022. So bringing winter sport, this is, you know, when I started that bid in 2009, that's how long ago we started that messaging. That was a message that kind of resonated with the Olympic movement, with the IOC, with winter sport, simply because it's an untapped market. And winter sport, like in Europe and North America, is kind of plateaued. You know, how much more can it grow? And now with less and less cities being able to host winter sports, that's even being constrained. And we didn't even know that back then, you know, All those years ago, 13, 14 years ago. So that is an example where, yeah, you're absolutely right, Ryan. You have to adapt and change. You cannot roll out the same. Were Chicago to bid today, by the way, Chicago had an excellent technical bid, from my opinion. I liked that technical bid. And all due respect, they didn't have a great story. And it was a very American.
Obama and Oprah weren't enough to sell it.
Yeah. No, that was a very American approach. I watched New York 2012 crash and burn. I watched Chicago 2016 stumble. And when 2024 came around, I was ready to go to work for one of the European cities. They'd already asked me. Yeah, I have a friend. I'd never worked in the U.S. I'd never had a U.S. bid. And I didn't really want one, to be honest with you, because I had watched two bids in the United States Olympic Committee in those days, USOC, now it's the USOPC. I'd kind of watched them stumble and fumble around. And I also knew that there was a pretty strong anti-American sentiment in the movement at the time. So 2024 took some convincing from some of my business partners to actually have a call. The call came from, as you read, the call came from Boston first, who I was there 4 months, I think, and by maybe the second month, it was obvious that that was not going to go well. And I hated to say it, but I said, I told you so. I just knew it's going to be a train wreck. And then I was asked, well, what about L.A.? And I just told you it's not going to work with a U.S. bid. Here are the functional problems, systemic problems with the U.S. bid. So they said, yeah, my partner said, let's just have one call with Casey. And I said, all right, I have 10 questions. We'll talk. And you read the post. So it turned out to be a good decision. And it was a really interesting bid to work on and a fun bid to work on. Challenging at times. Because frankly, LA and most American cities have a lot of smart, educated, aggressive people, i.e. American business people. And sometimes I work in places where I'm the only one in the room that knows what marketing is or branding or messaging or, and then when you get with a bunch of people who are professionals and educated and grew up in a, frankly, the most sophisticated sports marketing system in the world, i.e. the US. Yeah, it took a little getting used to with me and my LA friends, but we pulled it out and you saw the messaging that we won on and how we shifted away from a standard USA, USA, land of the free, home of the brave. We didn't talk about any of that stuff. We talked about the United States in honest terms. We were in the middle of a presidential campaign. It was fraught with intrigue with our friends in Paris who were using that campaign against us as evidence of why America shouldn't get the games. And that's when I made the decision, as you read, to use Allyson Felix to talk about things other than sport and other than winning Olympic medals and the promise of America as evidenced through somebody like her and her ancestors.
Sure. And part of it too was the fact that a lot of these Olympians are training here, regardless of what country they're from. So there is kind of that base, like the United States is the root system for a lot of these sports in the first place. And
the United States puts a lot of money in training foreign athletes around the world. And some that story's not known. It's not really told. And I'm not sure it needs to be told because it's a little hard to do that without sounding self-serving, but it is sure. A selfless commitment to the movement that the United States does and has always done. I think Americans would be kind of surprised if they knew the level of support and help that we do give other athletes from other countries that compete against us in the Olympic Games.
Well, what's interesting too is, I mean, for these bids, you're looking out six, seven, eight years, right? So what we know now as being the trend may not be the trend then, correct? So you've got to, granted, the IOC is making decisions based on things that are going on now and trying to project what will happen in 6, 7 years. What are some of the trends that you see kind of in this moment? Is it environmental? Is it no new construction? You'd mentioned, and there's been probably for a few decades now, this no Olympic movement. So what is kind of where are they hanging their hat on some of the things that the IOC is really looking for in this Olympic movement moving forward?
Yeah, you don't need to go back too far to remember bidding periods when there were 5, 6 of the biggest countries, cities in the world bidding to host the Olympic Games. The most recent one where they all made it to the finals was the 2012 Games, which London won. But you had 5 great cities and they all went through to the final. We all were in Singapore, made presentations in 2005. I was working for Moscow at the time, which may have been the worst Olympic bid I've ever worked on in my life, Moscow 2012. For a plethora of reasons. And I've spent many years working in Russia, beginning in 1992 with Delta Airlines, which is a whole nother story. But the Russians did not take that bid seriously. It was a local project run through the sports group in the city of Moscow. I'm not sure where all the money went or if any money was there. But interestingly enough, they recognized my effort and said, we want you to do Sochi 2014. And all I knew about Sochi is it was just a little summer resort down on the Black Sea. I didn't even know there were mountains there. And, you know, educated myself, went down. It was kind of an amazing place. Long story short, we did as part of our due diligence, we did a feasibility study on behalf of the Russian government to tell them what it would cost to host the 2014 Winter Games. And it was called the Federal Target Program for the Development of the Sochi Region. That was what was eventually passed. It was a law in the Duma. And we calculated about $12.5 billion US dollars. So at the end of the day, they spent maybe, according to media reports, 50. Was it 50? Was it 60? I have no idea. Yeah. It was a hell of a lot more than 12. And sadly, that got twisted around. And it became a focal point for cities thinking wrongly, we have to spend $50 billion to host an Olympic game. You know, it was even lost on whether it was summer or winter or whatever. It was just, we read that Sochi, the Russians spent $50 billion to host the games. We can't afford that. And that became, sadly, the narrative. And it was never effectively rebutted by anybody in the Olympic movement. I think they tried, but that was just a tidal wave of, I told you so, and negativity. And I think that was happening at a time where, you know, it's kind of like a perfect storm where cities and countries around the world were becoming more cognizant of things like legacy and sustainability for their citizens and their communities. And suddenly the IOC started seeing that bid process being affected by this, began with a faux narrative around Russia. Russia did spend that much money. They chose to spend that money. The IOC didn't tell them to spend that money. The IOC was well aware that they needed to spend about $12 billion to host the game, but that was a decision that the Russian state made. And it became this backward narrative that the IOC somehow caused them to spend $50 billion. And that's just not true. It just isn't true. But that became a narrative that got traction. And cities began thinning out and backing out. You know, you it's not your business, but it was several iterations and cycles of the games. You'd see a press release from the IOC, oh, we have six great cities who want to host the 2020 games or the 2022 games. And I remember thinking, please don't put that press release out. It's not going to be six cities. It's going to whittle down. And sure as heck it did. I worked for Almaty, Kazakhstan, for the 22 Winter Games when Beijing won. And the IOC, you know, made a wise choice. Almaty had a fantastic bid. They admitted it had a great bid. They didn't know anything about it. So they went with something they knew and trusted, i.e. China will make this work. At the end of the day, only China probably could have done those Winter Games under COVID. So that the whole process became shifted. And what's fascinating is when Thomas Bach became president of the IOC in 2013 and created something called the Olympic Agenda 2020 reform process, which is now the Olympic Agenda 2020 plus five. They canvassed everybody in our business to send in thoughts and ideas on what can we do better. It was a good idea, and it was sincere and well-intended. And I'm sure they got a lot of great ideas. I remember my paper, I sent in a paper, had two things. One was around brand management, managing the brand, going back to a traditional brand management process and curriculum that we invented when we worked there 20 years ago. And then I wrote about the bid city process. And I knew I was hurting myself. I said, we got to move away from a beauty contest, and you got to move toward a process that is more brand focused. You need to think about where do we want the Olympic Games in 10 years, in 8 years, in 4 years, or whatever it is, and go out to the cities now and start talking with them and helping them prepare so that if and when they become a real bid city or express their desire to bid on the Olympic Games, they're ready. There won't be another virtual bid. There won't be another Sochi. There won't be another, I hate to say it, Rio. There will be cities who are pre-tested, screened, and you'll have a healthy. So that was kind of my idea a long, long time ago, along with a lot of other people. This isn't just my idea, but I also knew it would probably put me out of a job, at least on part of what I do for a living. And it did. And they have moved to the new process that you know now. And I think their goal was to make this thing less expensive for bid cities, to try to create operational efficiencies by changing the rules. I mean, now you can have events all over the country or even in other countries. And 10 years ago, that would have just killed your bid. You know, it had to be one athlete village, everything within X kilometers. And so cities were kind of encouraged to build up infrastructure in places where they may not need it beyond the games, just to win the games. So you've got those operational expenses. And I think they put a much greater real focus on two words, legacy and sustainability. Those are the two most misused words, I think, in probably anywhere, not just the Olympics. But they really, really are focusing on that, Ryan. And, you know, I wrote a line. It's funny when I write lines for bids and then I see them regurgitated later on by the IOC. I take pride in that, even though I don't get credit. I remember for Madrid, I worked for Madrid 2020, and we were presenting in Buenos Aires in 2013. And I had a line that said, "We're not changing our city to fit the Olympic Games. We're making the Olympic Games fit our city." Well, that's become a line and a piece of mantra that the IOC uses now, and I'm glad they do. And the other line I read, if you have to build it, then don't. If you don't have it, you know, then don't bid. Or if you do have to build it, you need to make sure that that thing is sustainable and you can use it for many, many years to come. So I think it's just changed to a much more rational, sustainable, thoughtful process. Because I think the IOC also understands that the health of the Olympic brand itself cannot help but be impacted by the cities that they choose to host the games. Yeah. So if you choose a city to host the Olympic Games and it becomes problematic for whatever reason, that reflects poorly on the brand, that reflects poorly on future cities' interest in hosting the games, because they see something, a problem, negativity, that gets amplified everywhere, et cetera. So that's, to me, why they've changed. I applaud it. I think it makes a lot of sense. The process now is a little bit opaque, but they're also learning as they go. I think the process that they just awarded Brisbane 2032, a lot of people don't really understand it. I can't pretend I do, but the executive board made a decision that we're out of the risk business and we're going to look for cities that can give us much, can mitigate the risk, both reputational risk and operational risk of hosting the games. And I think they're not done changing it. You might swing back a little bit toward, as I said, let's pick five or three cities who may want 36 or 40 or 44. Let's screen them, make sure that they're viable candidates. And then maybe we can go back a little bit to the campaign where they're competing and you got a year or whatever it is or two to compete. You know, I think that's good for the Olympic movement. If you've got three or four great cities in the world saying, we want the games, here's why. And they're talking about that in the media round the clock because the Olympic Games only happen every 4 years. What do you do? How do you keep that excitement up? Well, the old bid process was one way to do it, but it had problems with it. That's been changed.
This all kind of started. I was in Munich a few weeks ago, and you know, the entire S-Bahn system and U-Bahn system was created as a for the whole downtown because of the Olympics in 72, and they were trying to get away from the thought of the Nazi games in 36. Obviously, they had their own struggles in 72 with the terror attack that happened. I don't mean to make light of it, but you know, it's hard when you're trying to erase or at least you know, better your history, and then that happens as well. But I talked to Stephen Brouse. He is he's helping the German Olympic Committee, kind of been put in charge of these public forums around Germany and getting a sense of how people would feel about bringing games back to Germany. Nothing specific, my understanding from him, Berlin, Munich, Hamburg, anything like that. I think they're just trying to get a feel for if there's an appetite. And my point to him is, no one ever asked me in Chicago what I thought about an LA bid. Like, why ask the public's help? Or why ask the public's opinion on this? Aren't they just going to say no? You know, isn't it a lot easier to say no than to say yes? I guess I just don't understand why Germany's going through this process of trying to drum up support among the people, or at least trying to figure out if there's enough support.
Well, I think why they're trying is they have two recent examples of where the general public said, no, we don't want the games. So they're trying to say, you know, here's the business case for this. It's not going to cost taxpayers any money. It's all upside. the games pace for themselves through broadcast and marketing.
Got a lot of the venues already. They've got a lot of these venues, right?
And they certainly do. And Germany has a wealth of venues. They could hold, frankly, the games tomorrow if they had to, if they spread it around. It doesn't have to be in Munich. Doesn't have to be in Hamburg. Doesn't have to be in Berlin or Frankfurt. It can be all over the place. And I think that's, it's a, you know, what's going on, and I hope it's going on, is an exercise in education about how the Olympics have changed, how the host city contract has changed. You know, that was part of the deal too. The reaction from the public in Scandinavia companies, for I work for Stockholm 2026. And we lost to Milan Cortina, which will have the games in 26. In a way, it was a shame. The Swedes were working very, very hard to create an alternative, creative solution to the IOC's host city contract, which cities have to sign if they win the Olympic Games. And there's a specific clause in that host city contract about revenue shortfall. If you don't meet your budget of X billion dollars, don't look at us. It's on you and your citizens. And the risk on that has never been big since Montreal in 76 made a mess of the games. But since then, Olympic organizing committees have done pretty well of not costing their citizens a lot of money. The games budget. Some cities that have won, like Tokyo, decided after they won that they were going to build a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
The non-organizing committee budget blew up. And I think that's another unfortunate reality that people who automatically say we don't want the games are going to cost more money typically gravitate toward that non-organizing committee budget. And they'll say, look, you know, Russia spent $50 billion. Well, that $50 billion, none of that went to the $2.9 billion budget to organize and host the Winter Games for 17 days. They're two different things. And that's a self-funding, typically, exercise and budget. The good thing about a place like, frankly, anywhere in Europe, but Germany, all that infrastructure exists. They don't need more hospitals. They don't need more trains. They don't need more hotels. They don't need more swimming pools. They don't need more venues. That stuff's there. You know, that was part of the LA story that you read about in my piece. It was a, it was nice to work on a bid where you had more than enough to consider of where to put things. You know, we had just a wealth of venues in LA, and Germany's the same. So I think the process that they're going through, and what little I hear about it, I just got an inquiry on it yesterday. Would I be interested in giving an interview? I think it's a new story for the International Olympic Committee. I think the games that the Germans historically in the past have said no to, that's not the reality anymore. And they need at least hear what the new reality is, and then they can make up their own mind. Western Europe has been a problematic for the IOC. You know, you do have the games in Italy, which is great. You got the Paris is next year. That's great. Those two great proof points of European countries and cities who want to host the games. So I think Germany, my personal opinion, would be a wonderful host. And I only have to look back to how they hosted the FIFA World Cup. And it seems like yesterday, even though, when was that? 06? I can't remember.
06, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My wife is German. I've lived in Germany. I worked in Germany. I've never seen a country. I've never seen a country's mindset, pride, and character change overnight the way they did. They became very proud of their nation and their country and German flags, you know, in front of homes, kind of like here in America.
Is not something that they're used to doing. That's for sure.
It isn't. And you know, they have pride in their country, but it's a very understated pride. like Germans themselves. But that city, that country came alive. They were perfect hosts. The games went off operationally without a hitch. And that's good too, obviously. But I hope that they can draw from that well of goodwill that people might remember from 2006. If I were they, whoever it is who's talking to them, it's a great proof point to use. I think the German nation would make an incredible host for an Olympic Games. And I hope it's sooner rather than later. It's good for it's good for the Olympic movement to have a country like Germany, France, et cetera, host a great summer games. And in Paris, we're all holding our breath and praying that it's going to be brilliant. I'm sure it will, because we need it, you know, coming out of COVID, coming out of three straight games in Asia, and they all did a great job under very hard circumstances. But we need to reengage the Olympic brand beyond Asia at the moment. And I think coming back to Europe will be a good thing.
I want to thank Mr. Terrence Burns for the discussion. I've linked the blogs that he's crafted specifically on the Pyeongchang and Los Angeles bids. If you want to get the real detailed information about what was going on behind the scenes to try to woo not only the people of these nations, but also the international community. The Pan Am Games continue. Holy cow, Team USA has already won more than 200 medals, including 90 golds. Want a full rundown? Well, you've got to look at the Team USA website. We've got that posted below as well. U.S. men's and women's 3-on-3 basketball teams have qualified for Paris. It's the first time for the men who were shut out of Tokyo. The women will look to defend their gold. We still don't know who will be on those rosters for either team. Legendary Olympic gold medal gymnast Mary Lou Retton went to social media this week for the first time since coming down with a potentially deadly bout of pneumonia. She said she's still got a long ways to go in recovery, but she is now at home. Her daughter announced Retton did not have health insurance, so people donated more than $450,000 to a fundraising website, including the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. We've got more topics to discuss about the games and, of course, the athletes themselves in the coming weeks. I'm Ryan Burrow. We'll talk to you next week on another episode of Quest for Gold.